Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Elle Kelly. Elle is a registered sport, eating disorder and disordered eating dietitian. Elle works with clients with eating disorders and disordered eating to improve their relationship with food and has excellent knowledge on this, specifically in the athletic community. Elle joins us today to share her research on eating disorders and disordered eating in the athletic population and explore how this can be navigated and supported. Hello, Elle.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Honestly, I'm so looking forward to this episode, and I've just knocked my microphone over as I'm trying to pick up my coffee. So that's clearly not going to happen. Yeah, I'm so excited. I think this episode, reading your dissertation was fascinating. And actually, I think when this is released, it's going to be such good timing for people because navigating these sorts of thoughts and conversations are so prominent at this time of year.
It's such a hard time, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like, I always think if Christmas wasn't bad enough for somebody mm-hmm. struggling with their relationship with food, like then comes January.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so difficult for sure.
Yeah, and I think you're so right. You've got, it's almost another layer of difficulty because you have all the pressures of Christmas and being happy, going to all the social events, doing this, doing that, eating all the food, and then it's like, okay, now you've done all of that, you've got to do the opposite. Gotta stop all that food that you've been eating, not allowed that anymore, and you've got to get to the gym and all of this. It's a minefield,
to be honest. I kind of feel like it's almost a, what's the word, like it's almost like a binge restrict cycle on a cultural level.
Absolutely.
Because it's like the promotion of all of these foods and like eating for the sake of, it being Christmas. And I want to preface by saying, eating for the sake of just eating is totally normal. And it's part of normal eating. And overeating is totally part of normal eating as well. But I think that if we kind of take a step back and think about it, December is like food is so kind of hyped up and encouraged, and then come January it's like diet culture kind of takes center stage again. Mm-hmm. And I think I had a couple of conversations like this with clients in the last few weeks. I can't think, and please do if you think of any other foods, but in my head the only foods that aren't available at Christmas or at any other time of the year, not Christmas, are mince pies and like Christmas pudding. I feel like everything else is available at any other time of the year.
Yeah.
Christmas dinner to me, and I'm sure I'll get some hate for this, Christmas dinner to me is just like a roast dinner.
It is, I was literally saying this to my mum yesterday. It's a glorified roast.
I know, it's just a roast dinner. And I think like chocolate, widely available at Christmas, also more than accessible throughout any other period in the year. So it is interesting, I think, on a cultural level, how we act around the season, for sure.
I mean, I know that there's the religious aspects, but I do think that most of those have been kind of, most people don't do Christmas now for the religious aspects, particularly, like you said, the Christmas dinner and the chocolate and stuff. But it is almost like it's been set up to you know, make you just buy everything because you're buying all of that stuff for Christmas. You've got to feel like you're having it all. And January comes. Okay, now you've got to buy all the diet products.
It's like get it all out of the house in January.
It's almost
like forecasting throughout December. It's like, we'll eat it all now because come January we're starting fresh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember, I always distinctly remember when I was a child, going into, in my house we have a utility room, and going in there like after my mum had done the Christmas shop, and it would be jam packed full of, you know, all the kind of Christmas picky nibbly things. I don't think as a family we even really enjoyed it, because then there was that pressure. It's got to be gone by the time we go back to work or school or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you just get so sick of like eating. I personally did. Like, I was just so desperate for like a normal meal. And I can imagine for people that have binge eating disorder or bulimia, those sorts of environments actually are so difficult to navigate, because one, you've got all that food that would be a massive trigger for binging, but also, you know, I think it's interesting, most of the year restriction is kind of glorified, I would say, but at Christmas binging is massively glorified and normalized, and the language that people use around sort of the way that they consume food, I can imagine is so difficult to navigate for people that kind of experience that as a compensatory behavior.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's so like normalized, and almost I think some people are almost justifying their own behaviors around that Christmas time by then kind of saying what they believe around the food at Christmas to other people, and there's that pressure then to kind of, I suppose, engage in those behaviors. But I think Christmas can be good and bad in many ways.
Yeah, here we are just like, Christmas is awful.
I know, yeah. Like, it does almost give us an opportunity, especially for people with binge eating disorder, to become quite, like, habituated to these foods. Like, this food is everywhere. And it's a bit of a push in the deep end. But it is, I suppose, just getting to that point where this is becoming, like, a bit more normal, the fact that it is everywhere and there are so many occasions. I don't think the anxiety and the overwhelm going into this season is helpful, because I think we then struggle to kind of like see it for what it is, and our brain takes us off in a tangent. But I think as part of, I suppose, the work that I do with clients who struggle with binge eating is very much using the concept of systematic habituation. You know, the more we expose ourselves to something, the more neutral that will eventually become. Ideally, I'd like to work with that with clients before Christmas so that they feel better around Christmas and around these foods at Christmas. But we can look at Christmas as a way to experience that and to experiment with that. It's difficult, but I definitely think it gives opportunities. And I think Christmas is the epitome of food not being fuel, food being so much more than fuel.
So true.
Food being, like, for me, I haven't been home to Ireland for the last 2 years because of COVID, and I am looking forward to nothing more than having like a Bailey's hot chocolate with my dad on the sofa when I do get home, and, you know, walking through Dublin City and getting whatever kind of festivities and festive food that is around. And that is not eating because you're hungry, that's eating because, you know, it's tradition, it's memories, it's so much more than just, you know, food being fuel.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And I really like that kind of
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. Social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations.
Switched kind of narrative on it, rather than seeing it as, you know, a really tough time that's going to be really difficult to navigate, actually taking it as a time to challenge yourself, a time to sort of expose yourself to different things, and, you know, not feeling like you have to do it all at once. You know, nobody's expecting you to, you know, be totally fine by the time that Christmas rolls around. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe using these uncomfortable feelings, and this Christmas might be uncomfortable, and that's maybe not what you want from Christmases forever. But by making yourself uncomfortable this year, next year could be so much better. And I totally agree, you know, Christmas is, and food in general is so much more than just the eating. I actually, sadly, yesterday was at a friend's birthday party, and they kind of had like a ploughman's lunch, and it was very like, you know, help yourself. But I just didn't feel like I could do it. And I had my lunch and then I went, and they were all kind of like picking at bits and then handing around chocolates, and they had cake, and I couldn't have any of it. I couldn't put myself. And I thought, you know, I'm not bothered by the cake. I'm bothered by getting involved and being engaged. Yeah. And that's the really important thing. And being like, oh, I'm so happy that I'm here for my friend's birthday. Not, oh my God, I really hope they don't ask me if I want to have a slice of cake or something. Yeah. So it's about being connected and enjoying yourself, and the food being an element of it rather than like the focus all the time.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not about the food. These social occasions around Christmas, Christmas Day itself, as much as the food does kind of take center stage, it's not the focus. It's, yeah, you know, being with family, being with people who you love. And I think that when it comes to social occasions, when we have an eating disorder or a challenging relationship with food, there's kind of angst and fear of judgment of what you're eating, what other people think you're eating. And the reality is that, you know, people don't actually care. Nobody's looking at what you're eating. It might be, you know, if family are, it's probably from a place of love and concern. But the reality is that 90% of the time, nobody's actually looking at what anybody's eating. And I think when we have an eating disorder or a challenging relationship with food, we very much judge ourselves. And then it's like this belief that everyone's kind of judging everything, but it's not. I think that's just such a good example that you shared there, that it's not the food you're conscious of missing out on, it's being involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is one thing that I have absolutely realized, is that actually no one gives a crap what's on your plate. They are so much more focused on what's on theirs and enjoying it themselves. So we were going to talk about kind of disordered eating and eating disorders, and you touched a little bit on it there. I guess to start with, what is the difference? You know, I think there's such a fine line between them, and I think people often get quite sort of, you know, is it disordered eating? Is it an eating disorder? So what do you think? What's your opinion on what the difference is?
I would like commonly explain eating behaviors as a spectrum. So on one end we have, you know, normative eating, which there's probably a question mark over that because normal for everybody is different. But we've got normal eating on one end, and then at the other we have what we consider a clinical eating disorder. So an eating disorder that's been diagnosed using the DSM-5 criteria. But I think in the middle we have what we would consider disordered eating. And I think the sad reality is that the minute I feel like a lot of disordered eating behaviors are pretty normal. But what we see when we use the kind of spectrum analogy is we see that people are edging more towards the clinical eating disorder side of things. And we know that actually somebody who engages in disordered eating behavior is actually at an increased risk of developing an eating disorder than somebody who's an intuitive eater or a more normal eater. So I do want to say that you don't have to have a clinical eating disorder, a diagnosed eating disorder, or an eating disorder that meets all the criteria of the DSM-5, which is what we use to diagnose clinical eating disorders. Like, you don't have to be at that point to struggle with your relationship with food. And actually reaching out at an earlier point is going to give you an even better kind of chance at changing your relationship with food.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really nice explanation. But I think it is so hard particularly for individuals, like you say, that maybe don't meet the full diagnostic criteria within the DSM-5. But yeah, I think it's really hard to navigate, because I've always thought, well, I do think, like, anybody that is sort of, it's having an impact on their life and they find it challenging, they find it difficult to navigate, obviously completely deserving of support and stuff. But I think that where the interest for me lies is that a lot of people when I'm with them, I think that's a bit disordered, but they're very happy in that. And I think that's where I find it really hard to draw the line in terms of that's just kind of their way. And if they're content with that, you know, is that an issue that needs approaching? And are they genuinely happy, or is it just kind of what they know as their norm? I think there's so many questions around it. And I think only you, it's so individualized. That's the kind of problem.
Yeah, it is so individualized. And I think you made a really good point there, that it's actually figuring out, is this having an impact on somebody's mm-hmm. life? Because even if it is the way that you've grown up, that doesn't mean that it's completely right either, if it is limiting you in some way. So it's really about, I suppose, working out what this is and how it is serving somebody. And if it's, you know, not impacting their life, then great. I think everybody should have the freedom to do what they want with food.
Yeah.
It's not anyone else's opinion, and in reality, what somebody else does with food shouldn't impact what we do. So if somebody is eating in a disordered way, fine. If that works for them. But I think it's really about kind of exploring, how does this impact somebody, and is this something that they actually want to change, and is it something that they feel does hold them back from living life to the fullest and being able to, you know, engage in social events? Because, like we've just been talking about, food is not just fuel, and you know, eating to keep your body alive is not kind of, it's surviving, but you're not exactly thriving. Because there's so much more to life than just kind of keeping yourself alive with food. And I think food is kind of the center of quite a lot of experiences in life, celebrations, traditions, memories. And if your relationship with food is holding you back from that, then that's an issue in my eyes.
Yeah.
That's something that we definitely want to see somebody getting support for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the key thing, isn't it? It's the impact that it's having on you personally. And if you're able to navigate situations and feel engaged and enjoy yourself, then yeah, it's pretty damn good. But if not, I think where it's another thing that interests me is sort of the sporting, maybe athletic community, particularly in the gym. And athletes, I think.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Disordered eating and eating disorders are... I go to the gym. The gym is a place that I love to go, and I just look around and I think, oh my God, like, it's just, it's normal to for the disordered eating patterns. You know, whether you're bulking, whether you're cutting, whether you're, you know, just generally have a disordered relationship with food because of the environment. And again, that's another one where I'm like, you know, where do we draw the line between what is okay for somebody and then what's disordered? I think it's so prevalent.
Yeah. I think it's such a common one that we see people doing this like in the name of health, like achieving a certain body type and eating a certain way in this like to support this idea that they're going to be healthy and they're supporting themselves. But there is a point where chasing that health status or being fit is actually counterproductive, and that's not healthy either mentally or physically. And like the definition of health is not just about, you know, your weight and the food you're having. It's also about your environment that you're living in, how you are mentally. Like there's so much more of that. So even if you are eating enough to support, you know, your lifestyle and you're physically healthy, if your relationship with food is holding you back, that's not healthy. It's really, it's definitely really like multifactorial with that for sure.
Yeah. And I know that you did your dissertation looking at sort of disordered eating and eating disorders in athletes. Why do you think that it's so much more common, you know, disordered eating and stuff in sort of the athletic population compared to maybe the general population?
So I think what's really interesting is that traditionally we've seen eating disorders and disordered eating being higher in the athletic population than in the normal population. And in 2004, there was a really large scale study done, and I found that 20% of athletes that were female actually met the criteria for an eating disorder, in contrast to 9% of the normal population, so the control group.
Wow.
But what was really interesting, what I found really interesting about this study, was the same publishers actually did a study 10 years prior to this. And they found that there was an 18% prevalence of females who would meet the criteria for an eating disorder in that athletic group. So the difference between 20 and 18 is it's still a growth over a 10-year period, but it's not as large as what they actually saw in the control group, so the normal population group. So that went from being 5 to 9% in a 10-year period.
Oh, wow.
So over the years, we have actually seen that there is, although a higher prevalence of eating disorders within the athletic group, the normal population, the prevalence is rising, and it's almost becoming kind of level, if you will. And when I was actually doing my dissertation, a lot of the more recent studies, so like the 2020 studies, the 2019 studies, it's definitely showing that there's like less of a difference in both groups. So it's really, really interesting. And going back to kind of your question on why that is, I think there's so many different reasons. And I think we know that it can definitely be linked to the pressure to obtain a certain physique in some sports. You know, in some sports, there's a belief that being lighter or leaner is faster, or that leaner is stronger. But again, we know that evidence shows that when a leaner physique or a lower BMI is achieved through disordered eating behaviors, it actually leads to a decline in performance. There's reduced velocity, reduced power output, reduced kind of running time. So it's actually counterproductive. And we also know that, like, obviously eating disorders can affect absolutely everybody, but there's no denying that there is a certain kind of personality types that can be linked with having an eating disorder. And those personality traits, I would argue, are almost kind of required to be an athlete, a successful athlete, you know, having high self-expectations, having low self-esteem, being tolerant of discomfort, being quite achievement-orientated. They're all kind of what we see is increasing someone's kind of predisposition to an eating disorder, but also somewhat required to be a successful athlete. Those personality types definitely have a role to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's a really key thing to note in terms of, you know, coaches or people that are working with athletes, in terms of being so aware that, you know, if somebody is an athlete, they're going to be a high achiever. They're probably going to be a perfectionist. They're going to have a lot of expectations put on them. That's a really high pressure environment. And, you know, leaning into certain behaviors or whatever to help, you know, either make weight or, you know, I don't know, fit a certain body type that's needed, I can imagine that that would be quite easy to slip into. But equally, on the flip side, you know, we are so aware of that. So as easy as it is to slip into that, it could be as easy to prevent by having the appropriate support, for making it an environment where mental health is openly spoken about and people can share, rather than it being something that is a weakness and is going to, you know, because I think it would be so easy to be like, oh no, I've got to be a good athlete, therefore I can't talk about this sort of thing.
Yeah, but I do think it is actually the similarities in these like personality traits, and then obviously the requirements of being an athlete. I would argue that it does make it harder to actually identify the symptoms, because it's like, is this person just really kind of committed to sport and showing up for training and doing extra kind of training sessions, or is this compensating for eating? Is this kind of exercise addiction? Is this compulsion? Like it does actually make it hard to really identify what is disordered here and what is somebody just trying to make it in their sport that they're really passionate about.
And I suppose as well, another thing that makes that really difficult, talk a lot about like identity and eating disorders, and you know, without your eating disorder, what will you be? An athlete, their sport, that does mean so much to them. And you know, I recently have been trying to like bring other hobbies into my life so that exercise isn't the only thing I'm doing. But if you are a professional athlete or really high performing athlete, and you're, you know, day to day involves a lot of that that sport, because that's what you have to do to train. If you did take that away, that would be a massive hole in your life, and that would be your identity. So yeah, the kind of entanglement must be so difficult to unravel in terms of, is this something that's sort of disordered, or is this just kind of the way that it is?
Yeah. And I think that also begs the question of like, why is somebody involved in sport? Like, where did that come from? What is this kind of, what are their personal goals out of it? And it was very interesting. A study done last year actually found that the identified reason for sports participation among some athletes was actually linked with eating disorder behavior, which kind of poses the question, is their involvement in sports a way to control and maintain an eating disorder, a way to kind of manage it? And this is a question I often kind of talk to clients about when they say to me, you know, exercise actually really helps me mentally and it clears my head and it gives me like, you know, kind of stability. And I completely agree with that. I think exercise can be 100% part of, you can like, exercise can be a really great coping mechanism for sure. But there's a really fine line when you have an eating disorder. And I always say to clients, does it make you feel better mentally because it justifies what you eat for the rest of the day, or because you feel better for having like eaten XYZ, or does it genuinely clear some space in your head? This is such a fine line, and I don't know the answer in figuring that out. I think that takes so much time to really kind of dissect your relationship with exercise. But yeah, it's so complex and so interesting.
I think my thought around that has always been, because I think it's really difficult to know if doing the exercise is helping you, because I think it can make you feel better and simultaneously be a compensatory behavior or whatever. I've always tried to think of it as, okay, rather than like what the exercise gives me, what happens if we can't exercise? Because somebody that didn't have a dysfunctional relationship with exercise would be able to go a day without kind of going to the gym, and they'd be, or you know, doing whatever exercise, and they'd be fine and they'd be able to be fully engaged. But when that thing is then taken away, if that's then an issue, you know, if that's something that causes you distress, I'd say that's kind of a really good identifier for when exercise is maybe not being used in the best way.
That's such a good way to look at it. And I think like what you said there, even if somebody doesn't have a dysfunctional relationship with exercise, there's also a bit of a fine line. You know, there's some days where somebody might wake up and think, I feel really tired, but on one hand, I know that if I go to the gym or do my class or do a training session, whatever it might be, I will like wake up, I'll be given energy and I'll have a great day. But then there's again a fine line between actually, am I tired? And is doing a session just going to make me worse? Is it going to put me in a bad mood? Like I've had, you know, sessions where I've thought I'll feel better after doing it and ended up walking out because it's just making my mood worse, the fact that I can't get eating. So, you know, it's really about, I think, in a way, tuning into your body. And I think that's so hard to do when you have an eating disorder, because there's such disconnects with your body. It's really so driven by your head, and rather than kind of the rest of your body sensations, that can be really hard to tune into and to identify. But it's really about kind of being able to learn your body and what's right for you. And again, not being influenced by then the external pressures that are there to exercise.
Yeah. And I guess with that kind of going back to what we were talking about, athletes, that is a really difficult thing to navigate, because if you're, you know, training for a competition or a game or something like that, that is exhausting. I used to compete for powerlifting, and that, like, when you'd be doing the peak, which is like a block just before you compete, and you kind of, the weights are going really heavy, you're lifting a lot of heavy stuff, and you are absolutely exhausted, and you're turning up to a training session thinking, I cannot do this. But it's that preparation for the competition. And so that's another thing that's so difficult to navigate, because in somebody that's not an athlete, you could identify like a ritualistic and rigid training schedule that they have to stick to. But with an athlete, you can't identify that, because they're provided a training schedule that they have to work towards in order to achieve their goals or to compete. So that's another thing. It's kind of taken out of their hands, you know, when they exercise and what they do.
But funny enough, I think that kind of goes back to what we were talking about before we started recording, about that intrinsic and external motivation, and really thinking like, why am I doing this? Because it's completely understandable that for certain things we go through, it's not going to be easy. And to achieve certain goals, we do have to kind of grit a little bit and go through certain things that we don't necessarily want to do, and things are going to be uncomfortable. And having to go through that discomfort to get to a certain place. But I really think it's then about evaluating, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because my parents really want me to be a swimmer? Or am I doing this because I really want to achieve that, and I eventually want to then work in sports for the rest of my life, or whatever it might be? So I think it's really about kind of thinking, where is this motivation, and is this pressure internal or external? And really identifying the motivation behind it.
Yeah. And that in itself makes it so hard, doesn't it? When you've got that external pressure to do things, whether that's from your parents or from your team or from your coach or whatever. I think for somebody with an eating disorder, that pressure maybe from the eating disorder to do certain things is bad enough. When it's actually real, saying it kind of like a real person saying it to your face, and all the kind of like, you know, no excuses, keep pushing, no days off, all of that kind of thing. Like there's literally so much that when you think about it is so negative. But I also don't want to say that, you know, all athletic communities are that negative. I think it's really important to highlight, you know, there is a purpose of the sort of culture and things like that, but I think just creating that awareness that it can be quite a dangerous environment.
Absolutely. It's so hard to really, as I said, fully identify, is this a symptom or is this somebody just wanting to be like good in their game? And I think we know that kind of eating disorders don't discriminate, but there is certain associations of certain eating behaviors within certain sports, and that is kind of seen as the norm, I suppose. And I think it's quite interesting to note that actually there's a higher incidence of eating disorders within the diabetic population. And I think this kind of begs the question, when you compare it to athletes and kind of the normal population, it is kind of considered normal that an athlete will be conscious of their food intake and will be conscious of their exercise output and all of these things. And going back to the diabetic population, you know, people who have diabetes actually do have to be aware of carbohydrate contents and like how they have to manage their insulin, and being really aware and reading labels of things. And I almost question, you know, does that constant exposure to these things, having to check these things, lead to then that obsession and like promote, the reality is it's far from normal eating behaviors, it is disorders. So it is just pushing you closer to that I suppose, eating disorder point on that spectrum. I think it's actually quite, like, as you said, with it being normalized in certain sports and kind of the culture that goes on, I would definitely want to bring attention to like weight class sports, like maybe boxing, where it's quite typical for somebody to crash diet or use diuretics or use laxatives in the lead up to a weigh-in. And then it's almost quite tradition to see that there's binging, most likely out of pure hunger, but also that kind of black and white mindset in the weeks throughout like a crash diet. And this is all, I think, that black and white mindset very much interlinks with quite a lot of eating disorders. And without sounding too stereotypical,
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Well, you know, when we think of ballet or dancing, anorexia and bulimia are very common within those sports. And this is a lot, I think, related to body ideals within sports and that culture. And again, a very recent study last year found that around 73% of athletes across different sports actually felt pressure by their sports to alter their physical wow. appearance to conform to gender and physique ideals, with 15% of them then consequentially engaging in disordered eating behaviors. So that side of the culture is really something I think we have to reevaluate, because as I said earlier, there's this myth that leaner is faster, or, you know, smaller is quicker, whatever it might be. And the reality is it's not always true.
Yeah, I suppose it's thinking about, you know, being the top of your game, but at what cost? I think it links back to that support element, because actually, if you're putting the pressure on somebody to weight cutting, I think is such a great example of when disordered eating can totally arise. And it's interesting, just going back to what I was saying about powerlifting. You know, this is a really sad sort of reality, but I don't think I met, obviously I was like a female powerlifter, so I engaged a lot more with female powerlifters than male powerlifters. So I couldn't say for the males, but I would say 8 out of 10 of, you know, with power, female powers that lifters that I'd met had an eating disorder and were then powerlifting. And at the time I thought, how great, you know, we're empowering ourselves, we're getting strong, we're doing all this. And then I thought, and then now looking back on it, I'm like, wow, we just kind of went from having an eating disorder to putting ourselves, you know, on a very rigid exercise plan, a very rigid diet plan, all wanting to be in the weight category below where we were. So we had to cut weight before the competition. And it was just an eating disorder in that kind of a glorified form and in an acceptable form. And I think that, you know, has the potential in a lot of sports, particularly, you know, think about boxing. I remember reading that a guy was, you know, self-induced vomiting because he was so worried about making weight, and rather than getting support, he was just kind of let go because he was engaging in those behaviors. And I think it, you know, hopefully that's not how it always is, but when you've got that pressure to be a certain way in order to be the top of your game, I think people do turn to, you know, very damaging behaviors. And like I said just a second ago, like at what cost? Because you lose yourself, and you like you were saying earlier about the intrinsic motivation. I mean, there can't be any when you're having to put yourself through things like that in order to be good at your sport.
And then going back to what you said, like, what happens when you cut sport out of your life? You're left with these behaviors don't just go away with it.
Yeah.
You're unfortunately left with that kind of concern around your weight the whole time, your activity levels, your intake, and those compensatory behaviors, they become a coping mechanism. So that, you know, coping mechanism will merge and there'll be other uses for that. So it's so complex. And the culture of sport, like you said, I think can be a little bit passive towards it. And again, that's not me bashing the culture of sport. I think sport in itself is one of the most amazing things that we have, but it is really hard to actually identify, you know, what is an issue versus not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the line I'm finding really hard to tread in this conversation, is that sport is, you know, it has such great elements in terms of it's massively, you know, the community and the enjoyment that people get from it and things like that. And it can be so brilliant. Do you think that sort of the more maybe weight dependent and sports that have a certain physique, that eating disorders and disordered eating are more prevalent than, I'm trying to think of a sport, when we say like non-weight dependent sports, are we talking about things maybe like football and that sort of thing? And then when we talk about weight dependent, things like boxing and ballet and things like that.
Yeah. So I think lean sports are typically the aesthetic sports. So leanness is maybe encouraged purely for aesthetic reasons, like boxing, like bodybuilding or gymnastics. But not all lean sports then rely on aesthetic appearance as the determinant of success. However, they do place an emphasis on a lean physique and enforce kind of greater pressure on athletes to maintain that set physique. So examples of that would be maybe athletics, swimming, cycling, figure skating. And then the weight dependent sports often kind of come into that category too sometimes. And sports like boxing, as you said, or wrestling will typically have weight classes, powerlifting again. And that's purely to regulate competition and make it as fair as possible. But as you said, it is sometimes putting like an emphasis on numbers and like, how heavy can I lift at my lightest body weight almost?
Yes. Then
trying to give yourself an advantage. It's really common for people to compete and to typically be kind of training at a weight class that's above what they then want to compete at. So it then takes a lot of the manipulation, like the water loading and cutting and depletion and laxatives and diuretics, all of that kind of stuff. But then like the non-lean sports and non-weight dependent sports are typically the technical ones like golf or ball sports like basketball. And I'm sure quite unsurprisingly, sports where leanness is encouraged, especially purely for aesthetic reasons, is associated with an increased risk of developing an eating disorder. And when we classify lean and non-lean sports are associated with a higher prevalence of disordered eating behaviors and eating disorders. And in the research study I did do, 5 out of 6 studies concluded that eating disorders and disordered eating behaviors were higher in athletes within lean sports than non-lean. But I suppose when it comes to the type of eating disorders within each sport, as I said earlier, there's sometimes a bit of a culture, and maybe like binging is more common in one, and anorexia and bulimia and restrictive eating might be more common in another. But there's no solid evidence to say that X sport leads to X eating disorder or eating behavior, but there are associations we've seen. So binge eating disorder is more common among aesthetic focused sports than endurance sports, with a study finding that actually the incidence of binge eating in male bodybuilders was around 46% in comparison to 12% in male rowers. And I think as you said, similar to powerlifting, you go through a phase where you're going to be going through diet phases. And we know that then restriction is one of the main driver for binge eating behaviors. So that makes sense. But yeah, it is quite shocking to hear those kind of stats, isn't it?
That's crazy. But I don't know whether this is a really sad realization, but I am shocked. I'm shocked that it's that high, but equally, like when I think about it, I'm not surprised, because I think just in, you know, I see bodybuilding as like extreme gym culture. And I think just walking around my gym, the conversations people have, you know, one person's cutting, one person's bulking for no other reason, you know, they don't have a sport to be doing it for. They're just doing it because they've heard the terms floating around the gym. And, you know, that sort of binge restrict cycle is so glorified. I know so many people that with like during the week they will literally put themselves in such a massive calorie deficit, and then the weekend comes around and they're just, you know, they're like a kid in a candy shop, like consuming everything that they possibly can, but don't see that as problematic. But I think
because it's a cheat day.
yeah exactly, yeah, which is just, you know, the fact that that has become so normalized is quite scary. And I think that's what scares me as well, is the sort of influence that maybe more senior or more, you know, experienced people have. Because, you know, I know I keep going on about powerlifting, but that's kind of my experience in sport, because yeah. I'm not a very sporty person, so powerlifting's all I've ever done. But I remember, you know, I just wanted to do it for fun. And my first competition, I was about 0.5 kilos over the weight category. And so the person that was providing me my training plan told me to cut weight. So my first competition, I was there cutting weight. And I didn't even question it because everybody was doing it. But nobody, yeah. Hardly anybody was bulking up to the next weight category. And I was like, why are we all trying to, you know, why are we making ourselves weaker? But it was just so normalized. And I think that's the scary thing. You don't actually stop to question the behaviors, because if all your teammates are doing it, why would you question it?
Yeah. And when you're so involved, and especially if sport is something that's been quite a big part of your life for a long period of time, it does just become quite embedded in you. And it's just kind of the ways, I suppose. But yeah, like you said, when you're having to cut weight, that the likelihood is that you're just dropping like water, and you know, training in a dehydrated state isn't great either. You're not exactly setting yourself up for performing, which is what sport is about. And I think that we really lose sight of that. Like you said, like, why is nobody going for the higher category? It's quite obvious that as good as sport is, I think a lot of people, especially who come from an eating disorder background, like, we learn foods can really kind of provide us with fuel and really kind of make us feel amazing. And I think sport can sometimes be the door into that kind of world for somebody who's coming from that place. But at the same time, I don't think sport is like, what's the word, free or kind of not affected by diet culture as well. And, you know, that idea that smaller is better, and like this fear of being heavier or being bigger. And I think we see that a lot with like the Instagram and Fitspo community, that it's almost like, you know, women are expected to, nowadays it's kind of on trend to be more toned, have more muscle, and but still at the same time, like, you shouldn't expect for your weight to go up, which is like a bit contradictory because, you know, women are trying to put on muscle, but they don't want their weight to go up. So it just shows how deep rooted these fears and, like, you know, weight. And I think with sport, there's naturally an obsession on numbers. And you might have experienced it when you were powerlifting, like, it might be how much you weighed or what you're eating, but it was probably the numbers you were lifting, and there was probably a certain number in your head that was deemed as successful and deemed as failure. So it really kind of promotes that obsession with numbers again, which will then kind of impact your life outside of being an athlete. And I always say this to clients, you are a human. You know, you show up for training, but you still have bills to pay like every other human. You still have physical, biological needs like every other human. And that's not something to forget.
And I think this, the whole like focus on numbers actually really translates, I don't want to say well as in like it's a good thing, but it does translate so easily into an eating disorder. You know, I think the example that I always think about is you know, with, let's say, anorexia, there might be a number on the scale that you want to see, but by the time you've got to that number, there's already a new number in mind. Yeah, you don't say, oh, you know, we got there, yay, well done. That's great. It's you're not at that next number. And that was exactly what I experienced in powerlifting. You know, I wanted to hit a 130 deadlift, but by the time I got to 130, I was already aiming for 140. And then by the time I got to 140, I was aiming for 150. And that was never seen as a problem because you know, you have that, like we were talking about earlier, those perfectionistic, those goals driven characteristics, you know, really striving to be the best you can be, which is brilliant. But I think having those characteristics, yes, amazing, and you know, I'm very grateful because it's made me the determined person I am, but actually being able to pause and acknowledge, oh my god, you just got that, that's amazing. Obviously not with weight loss, say that, but in your sport, or whether that's at work or in academia or anything that you're doing, being able to actually acknowledge that you've achieved it rather than just like, okay, what's the next one?
Yeah. And that is such a big problem, I think, with eating disorders. And I say this as a recovering perfectionist, that I think when you are so perfectionistic and have such high standards of yourself, there's two ways we can go about it. One, you might never reach that, and then it's just constant reinforcement and validation that you're failing. When the reality is you aren't. If you kind of zoom out, you're probably doing amazing and achieving so many other things, but it's not as high as the bar you've set yourself. But then the other element is, like you said, you actually do achieve that, but because you're so focused on the next level, you don't stop to celebrate that. And it's like this never ending kind of trying to seek this thing that doesn't actually exist. And we really do have to actually sometimes stop and pause, and like you said, celebrate those big achievements, even though you don't see that they are like, oh my god, I've just, you know, hit this number, that's amazing, can I just pause and kind of be in this moment and embrace that rather than constantly chasing the next thing. Right, so that does make you, in one way, you know, it is beneficial to have those kind of personality traits in some things, but I think when you're constantly chasing something, and like we spoke about that earlier as well, there's like that risk of burnout and just not actually being happy, not actually being satisfied. And you're constantly thinking, when I get to this, especially with anorexia, when I hit this number, I'll be happy. You never will. And until you kind of come to that realization, you will keep chasing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually had this conversation with a friend of mine the other day who, I was talking about...
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino's a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this. Even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
How I constantly aim, I feel like I'm chasing the dragon in terms of like whenever I set myself a goal and I never actually acknowledge that I've reached the goal. But sometimes with particular things, I over celebrate. So, you know, like birthdays or getting a new job or something like that. It's like the biggest, most amazing thing. But it never quite feels good enough because the expectation I have from achieving that is, you know, it's not, it never feels as good. And she was saying that what she advises her clients is to kind of mess it up a little bit. So sometimes when you do something really good, yeah, go out and celebrate, you know, get yourself a glass of Prosecco or buy yourself a box of chocolates or, you know, have a party with your friends. But then also if you do something, kind of just acknowledge that you did it and move on, and kind of not giving yourself that sort of high every time of like, oh my God, that was amazing. You know, sometimes just being like, yeah, that was cool that I did that. Well done me. And then moving on with your life actually over time helps you to appreciate achieving the goal even more, because you're not expecting like groundbreaking changes to happen from it. You're just like, that was really cool that I did that. And I'm really proud of myself. And now I'm going to carry on.
That's such a nice way to look at that. I really like that. But I do think, and sometimes I'll get clients to keep like a bit of a milestone chart. And like you said, like celebrate those small wins, because those small wins do actually add up. And a lot of the time they are what actually determine then the bigger wins and the bigger successes. So acknowledging those. But then, like you said, not being so caught up with it, and actually giving yourself, I think, credit overall that you can do these things, and you don't have to always celebrate these small things. You can still, you know, give yourself that credit even when you're maybe not going in the direction that you want to be going. And that whole kind of concept of self-compassion is very important there as well, within eating disorders and within that kind of perfectionistic traits. Definitely.
And just before we finish up, one thing that I kind of wanted to touch on with you that we kind of haven't got to yet, but is a big consequence of undereating and kind of overperforming, I guess, that I don't think is massively spoken about, but definitely should be, which is kind of why I want to change the topic to it, is the female athlete triad and low energy availability. So I wondered if you could explain to us what they are and maybe how they can present in athletes.
Yeah, so the female athlete triad illustrates the relationship between low energy availability, hormonal changes, and decreased bone density. But the concept has kind of evolved in the last couple of decades, and we now acknowledge that males actually suffer from low energy availability too. And before I go any further, I really want to mention that men tend to have a higher threshold for low energy availability. So this actually means that when men start to experience the symptoms of low energy availability, it's quite severe at that point. So I think that in itself, although, as you said, like LEA is not spoken about enough for low energy availability, it's also not spoken about enough in men. And men actually do struggle, like experience it. And I don't know whether that's because we commonly associate LEA with period loss, and obviously men don't have a period, so there's no kind of signpost for that. But it is hopefully, I mean, I hope that it is starting to be spoken about more and we recognize it a bit more. But as you said, you know, LEA does have a lot of consequences, both health-wise and physically and psychologically, but also on performance. And the sad reality is that this is when coaches start to get concerned for their athletes, and even athletes start to get concerned themselves as well. And I mean, I completely understand that the loss of a period is, you know, quite great in some cases, because it's not this inconvenient thing, especially when you're active, and maybe those kind of hormonal changes do influence your training. And I think this is why the education is so important, because there's nothing glamorous about losing your periods. You know, and it's not just your period. And I think a lot of there's this misconception that I'm not planning to have babies anytime soon, like your period is just kind of for your fertility. But actually, you know, bone density decreases by about 2.5% every single year that you don't have a period. Cardiovascular system is impacted. I often explain, so I've realized I've not actually explained what LEA is. So before we dive in any further, LEA is essentially, you know, caused by imbalance in energy, and that's either created by high energy output or decreased energy intake. But we do often see that actually underfueling and overtraining go hand in hand. And energy availability refers to the amount of energy that the body has remaining for biological functions when the energy for training or activity has been covered, because this is what the body will naturally always prioritize. So low energy availability, or LEA, describes the state where your body doesn't actually have enough fuel left over from using it for exercise or training to support the normal biological functions that we need. So in very simple terms, energy expenditure is exceeding the how much energy we're taking in. And so I think falling into LEA can be unintentional, where an athlete simply underestimates the amount of energy that they need for their training as well as their day-to-day functions. Or maybe we get too caught up on our sports performance nutrition and forget that actually as a human, we still need more. We still need energy. Mm-hmm. We still need certain nutrients. But it can also be intentional. And usually that's when it's related to maybe the aims of changing your body composition or linked with an eating disorder. And I often use the analogy that low energy availability is like low power mode on your phone. You know, your phone goes into a state where it's trying to conserve as much power for the basic functions, like keeping it on for an emergency. And it kind of stops all of the background stuff. And I often explain our body is like this combination of systems. We've got our immune system, our reproductive system, cardiovascular system, thermoregulation system. And basically, these all start to become downregulated because the body, these all cost energy to run, and the body doesn't have enough to keep them going. It's like thinking about, you know, your budget. If you realize your income's going to be cut, you're going to reevaluate what you're spending money on. And obviously your mortgage or your rent or your bills and your food is going to be your priorities. And maybe going to the cinema twice a week, or the coffees you buy yourself throughout the week, or going on holidays, that's not considered essential. So you're going to kind of cut them and prioritize making sure you have enough money to cover these essential things. And that's really what's happening with your body. All of these other ones get down regulated, and that just can cause a whole host of complex things that happen within our body. And you know, it results in a reduced production of hormones, which then can lead to loss of periods and sex drive, impacting fertility in both men and women, but then also impacting our bone health again in both men and women. LEA will also influence our sleep, our immunity, feeling cold all the time, obviously feeling low in energy as well. But then there's the impacts on our psychological health too. Brain fog, impaired cognitive function, they're all common features of LEA. And low mood and increased anxiety is also often observed within studies as well. So many consequences of LEA. It's not just like, I don't have a period, or I'm feeling low, I'm feeling tired and energy. We don't actually think what else is going on inside of us. And as I said, it's normally when the performance starts to dip that coaches and athletes kind of think, oh shoot, like what's going on here? And that's often when I'll start seeing a client and they'll be saying, you know, my performance has dropped. And they're not really concerned about the fact that we haven't had a period in 5 months or been alarmed by that. So I think there's a lot of kind of education that needs to happen there for sure. And really, yeah, really, again, going back to it being so hard to identify between the symptoms of disordered eating and actually just being committed to your sport, it's so hard to identify again.
Yeah. I think what you've just said there about like being the concern coming when maybe performance goes as opposed to the lack of a period or whatever, it kind of just demonstrates how someone could be just seen as a machine to kind of perform rather than actually thinking about them as a human. But I'm just really appreciative for you sharing all of the sort of things that can be impacted, because I very much am a person that floats along, thinks everything's fine, you know, it's all good, I'm surviving, it's great. And actually I think it was the bone density one, every year you lose 2.5,
around 2.5% of your bone density.
Yeah.
And the thing with bone density is it peaks for women. I really honestly don't know the answer, because I feel like there's a lot of mixed studies. I feel like it's in your mid to late 20s that your bone density kind of peaks, and there's actually like no improving that from that point. So you can maintain it, but if your bone density is, you know, decreasing consistently up until that point, you're going to have a low point, and that's going to increase your risk of osteoporosis and osteopenia. And I think people associate those diseases with being elderly, but the sad reality is there is no age on that. You know, I've clients in their 20s who have osteoporosis. So it's I think like you said, there's not enough kind of talk on the impacts and the lifelong impacts, because yes, you can improve, definitely you can reverse a lot of the effects of LEA, but that bone density one is unfortunately, there's a certain point that we can't rectify much.
Yeah, sorry I've gone quiet, but that's really kind of shook me. I think mm-hmm. it's very easy to, like you say, just think, oh, that only happens to old people, and not think about how your actions right now actually impact what's going to happen in the future. But I think sometimes we need to hear the reality of things, because it can be so easy to be so engulfed into the eating disorder or disordered eating and just think, yeah, everything, you know, I'm fine. When actually maybe it's not, you know, thinking about the long-term future.
But like you said, when you are in the middle of an eating disorder, it's hard to see anything past that. You know, it is hard to imagine your life in 20 years time and the long term effects of that. And I don't think that that's on the individual. That is very much, unfortunately, the way an eating disorder works. We really struggle to see outside of it and past it. And so, you know, when you're in the middle of an eating disorder, you're not concerned about what's going to happen tomorrow. You're more worried about other things. So it's understandable that that is hard to see. And I think this is why that message needs to just be consistently and repeatedly, you know, put out there for people to recognize maybe before they slip into that. Because I think, like, even when we think about dieters and people who diet, nobody really thinks about the consequences of constant yo-yo dieting and how that over periods of time impacts your heart health. Like, I think it's just partially quite normal for us not to think of them, because we don't talk about them enough. And until we start talking about the consequences, I think that is when we start to realize and kind of evaluate our behaviors before we take them. Because if we just look at the glorified results of dieting or of an eating disorder, it is very easy to forget about actually the negatives.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. And I always find it really funny, actually, in that I always think that my eating disorder takes me from living in the moment and like embracing the moment and stuff. But in a really weird way, it actually makes you live in the moment, but kind of like for the wrong things. But it's like everything is so fine now, and you don't think about the consequences of your actions right now on the future. But almost in like a maladaptive way, because it's like, well, this one thing that I'm doing right now, you know, it's just a small thing, it's not going to impact it, but actually it has the biggest impact. But you're not living in the moment in terms of like enjoying yourself and being spontaneous and just like letting things happen and being out of control.
I think you overthink the consequences for the eating disorder and not the consequences for you. Because like you said, that identity becomes a little bit difficult to actually kind of, you know, identify. And I think that, it's very normal. Like you said, you're in the moment for the wrong reasons. You're thinking about the wrong reasons. And this is what I mean, you know, when you're talking to somebody in the depths of an eating disorder about their bone health and about their fertility and about, you know, their heart health, they're kind of sitting there going, I'm really just kind of maybe still ruminating on what I ate yesterday, or, you know, this is not relevant to me right now. That is completely so understandable, and I think that just really highlights how much an eating disorder does take.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Elle, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and a lot of what you said has really hit home for me today. So I'm just really grateful for having this chat with you. Where can people find you for more information, or if they want to speak about and maybe getting some support themselves?
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Han. So my Instagram handle, it's kind of the only social media I'm on, is Elle Kelly Nutrition. And my website is eknutrition.com. They're probably the two best places to find me at.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. And stay warm. No snow.
No snow. Please, snow, stay away.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe.
Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.